right, everybody, we are back for episode 2. We are so excited to do another one and really get talking today. So like we said in the first episode, we don't want every episode to be just only about our autism journeys and our autism stories. But for the first few, I think we're going to start there because that's where most people know us from.
And that's how we landed here.
Exactly. And that's how we got to know each other. So we're going to start with our diagnosis stories. And I know we touched on them a little bit in the first episode, but we're just going to go back to the very, very beginning before we knew that this was going to fundamentally and completely change both of our lives, which it did. So am I elected to go first?
Yes.
Okay. We talked about this before, so I got elected to go first. So Tanner was born in November of 1998. Taylor is older, my daughter. Taylor, she was born in 96, and Tanner had absolutely nothing that would have ever made me think that anything was going to be amiss, as in he was a 7.5-pound, 22-inch, big, strapping, healthy newborn. He nursed well. He was an extremely healthy baby. He grew incredibly fast. Tanner actually hit all of his milestones, if anything, on the early side. He sat up at 6 months. He was crawling by 8. He was walking by 10. And you know, I know a lot of times with autistic kids, I'll say there were a lot of delays like from the get-go, or they were maybe a poor feeder or had a lot of sleep disturbance, or you know, lots of maybe little telltale signs that were happening in infancy that they later realized, oh, you know, that might have been my tip-off. Well, for us, it was not that way. Tanner was, if anything, the first 7 weeks, it was a little rough sleeping, but once I got him on a schedule, he slept like a champion. So needless to say, we're going through life with our, you know, toddler dauber who was extremely precocious and early talker, and our adorable, precious little boy. And it was about the winter of 2000 when Tanner was turning 2. He turned 2 in November. And we went on a trip to Illinois to see my family for Christmas. His birthday's in November. And I'm not going down this path, but I will say this always stands out in my mind. Tanner had gotten a really bad head cold. It had some fever, just some kind of viral sickness. And it had turned into what we think was a sinus infection. He'd gotten his 2-year-old vaccinations. And then we put him on an antibiotic in very close proximity because we were getting ready to go. I really tried to avoid antibiotics at that time as much as I could and just let things work themselves out. But I was concerned we were getting ready to make a cross-country trip. He was young. I didn't want him to be miserable. So he just had his 2-year-old vaccinations, and we put him on an antibiotic. We go home to Illinois for Christmas, and it was shortly thereafter. I don't know if any of that is related. I don't have any idea. I know there's a lot of controversy about those topics. I just know that that's how the timeline went. And it was pretty shortly thereafter that I just started to notice. The first thing I noticed was a definite change in affect. He was a smiley, engaging, bright-eyed, happy, sunny little boy. He just got much more serious. His whole range of expressions became much more flat. He seemed kind of lost. He just seemed a little bit spacey and lost a lot of the time. Like I would have to call his name twice, or you'll get right on him and touch him to get his attention. And I remember just little warning bells going off in my gut and just thinking, something just feels the tiniest bit off to me. But life was moving fast. We have these little kids. We were getting ready to build our home that we live in now. And I just kept pushing it to the back burner. At that time, we were involved in lots of play groups. You know, we were young moms. We were all doing everything we could to be social. And beyond the change in affect and the little bit of demeanor change, I started noticing at play groups that if all the other kids were on the swings, Tanner was walking to the slide and just doing things like pouring dirt down the slide, which is not in and of itself an abnormal activity for a little boy. It was the way he did it and the fact that he seemed so lost in
methodical.
It was methodical, so methodical. And he just kept doing it. And someone would call his name or a little kid. And if a little kid came over, rather than looking at them excitedly and like, here, you take
a lot of experience.
Yeah, let's do this together. He would turn and go somewhere else as if the other child's presence was, you know, just a little bit abrasive to
interrupting.
Him. Yeah. And he just didn't like it. He also had these little, we were a farm family. He had this cute little set of John Deere tractors, and he would lay on his side with one arm on that one head, his head on that little arm. And he would take them and he would just roll them back and forth. Again, that's not abnormal for a little boy to do. But then I'll never forget it. I can see him. He would just lay in there. He'd do the roll about 3 or 4 times, and he'd pick it up. His eyes would follow it, and he'd bring it back down. And then he would do it again. And I remember just thinking, wow, he is intense. Maybe I was like, he's going to be brilliant. He's going to just be, he's like an engineer. Yeah.
Prodigy.
Yeah. He's going to build these tractors someday. He's looking at how it's made. But it did something in me. And I just thought it seemed odd that a little 2-year-old boy was that intent on this very, I mean, a little tractor, like he could hold in his little hand. So those things were happening. And, you know, but we continue, we're just going through life. We would go into, you know, well visits and, you know, checkups with the doctor. And Tanner never lost language. He was still, you know, acquiring language. He was talking. He was making his needs known. He was calling people by name. He was looking at us. And so we'd go for a short 15-minute doctor visit. And I mean, and not in any way saying the doctor should have known.
He just flew under the radar.
Yeah, he just flew under the radar because he could talk. He could answer questions. He would behave appropriately. He was very warm and affectionate with me always, and with Mark and with Taylor. And so there were just little things that were just making me feel uneasy. So that we kind of just stayed right there for a while. And then I started noticing that when I would leave him, church nursery, I was a stay-at-home mom, so I was home with him most of the time. I worked a few shifts a month as a nurse, but not a lot. And when I worked those, Mark would be with him. But I remember when I would take him to church nursery or to a playgroup setting or any kind of babysitter, he would cry. And I'm normally not the kind of mom who would like coddle or put up with that, but it was like this heartbroken, like he really believed I was never coming back. And it was just so sad. He has the prettiest hazel eyes, and his eyes would just well up with tears, and he would just hold out for me. And then he had this little blanket. It had a Noah's Ark pattern on it, and he called it his lovey. And then he would just kind of give up, and he would just hold his lovey and just suck his thumb. And he would just look so pitiful and sad because, you know, a couple of times I would come back, and the church had a little mirror door you could look through to make sure he was okay. And he would just be sitting in the corner by himself, just like sucking his thumb and holding his lovey, but not playing with anybody. And I kept thinking, what is going on? Like, why is he not social? What is happening? So we go through these things, and, you know, occasionally mentioning stuff to the doctor, like, I'm a little concerned, you know, he's not real social. He doesn't interact real well with other kids. He pushes interaction away, if anything. I just feel like something's a little bit off. But again, he keeps flying through checkups. And physically, he's a big, strapping, healthy, eats well, sleeps well, no sign of anything. And we're like, no, you know, he's just not going to be a talker. He's got a more reserved personality than Taylor does. Don't worry. And not to say that anyway, I was not pushed aside. It was just, it was logical. It was logical for someone that didn't see him all the time. So we go through that. And the next thing that I noticed was that was during the days of
being. Were you doing any like repeating your words or tippy-toe walking or anything? Did he have any? I don't know what.
At that time, like, he was tiptoeing a little bit. It wasn't prominent for him. That wasn't a huge one for him.
I'm just curious.
Now that I look back, it was a little bit.
Okay.
Like, there's a few videos and stuff that I took, and he does come up on those toes a lot, but that wasn't like a hallmark one for him.
Same.
After I started to notice those little subtle things, and then it was kind of like 3 really significant things happened. He had a shirt that had a picture of a tractor on it, and he had another shirt that had a little airplane design on it. And he got like, and Tanner still has a lot of issues with OCD to this day. He got just obsessed with those 2 shirts. He would wear nothing but those 2 shirts. So he'd wear one, the other one would be in the laundry for the next day. And we would flip-flop those 2 shirts. And he would scream and just get, you know, just panicked almost if we tried to put any other shirt on him. And that's when I started thinking, okay, whoa. This is not normal. And like I said before, I normally would not have put up with that. From like a little too, I would have been like, no, you're going to wear the shirt I put on you. But it was like this mournful fear. It was like fear of any other shirt. And Mark was like, let him wear the doggone shirt. It's not going to hurt anything. Just, it's a phase. He'll come through it. Let him wear the shirt. So we sort of let him wear the shirt for a while. And then I started noticing, this was the days of VHS, which a lot of people listening may not know what VCRs are, but that was when we used to watch the movies.
They all did.
Yeah, big old tapes, but they have a big, thick cover. It looked like a book. And he was got very, very, very obsessive with Land Before Time, dinosaur movies. And he would sit with those VHS covers And just, he would study them like he was studying, like, to take the bar. I mean, he was, I mean, he would hold them, he would turn them, he would just stare. We'd ride all the way to Columbia, which is a 45-minute drive. We went all the time. And this little two-year-old sitting quietly, immersed in a cover. The same picture, not a book, not turning pages, just staring at it.
The cover.
And it used to just make my blood run cold. I'd be like, that is so weird. There's something so weird about that. And then shortly thereafter, when I started noticing that hyperfixation, the obsession with the shirt, the hyperfixation on the video covers, that's when he started to stem and he started to flap. And for Tanner, he did a lot of really rapid hand flapping by his ear. And he had a lot of like twitching and jerking. Yeah. Yeah. A lot of very ticky behavior. His gaze, I always feel like his peripheral vision is stronger. I don't know this. I've never had it proven or had, you know, an eye doctor tell me that. But I feel like he sees things very acutely out of the corners of his eyes. And I felt like he was always kind of looking to the side and he started to flap. And I remember I would take his hand and I would put it down and I would, Tanner, you know, and then he would, yeah, he'd look at me.
Interesting.
But the minute I would leave him alone, he would start to flap. And I remember I would always just feel like nauseated. Like I would look at him and I'd be like, why is he doing that? You know, I didn't know what it was. And so we were at a gathering. We were actually at a tailgate at a Clemson game. And it was just a community friend. And she worked in the education field. She worked at the technical college near us. And she had a daughter, Taylor's age. So that we had gone to the game. And he's not playing. You know, he's off by himself looking at his tractors, kind of staying away from everybody where Mark was holding him. And I was speaking to this friend, and she works in, she teaches in the early childhood education department at our local technical college. And I started saying, Jody, you know, obviously this is my first little boy. He's doing some things that I'm finding kind of odd. I just, you know, I don't understand. And I started listing off everything that I just described. And I'll never forget, she looked at me and she said, Nikki, she was like, she like took my hand. She was like, I don't want to upset you. She goes, but it sounds to me like he's autistic. She said, that sounds like autism. And it was just like.
That's a hard thing for a friend to come out.
Yeah.
I mean, that was kind of brave on her.
It was.
Because you could have really
galloped out. Gotten upset. And I said.
So you're at a tailgate.
We're at a tailgate. And
what's he doing? Is he playing there?
Yeah. I think he was doing what he was always doing, removing himself and playing with the little toys that we had brought for him. Or Mark was holding him. You know, one of us would hold him or whatever, because he didn't want to be with all the other little kids. And I looked at her and I said, what do you mean? The only association I had for autism was the movie Rain Man. Literally, that was the only thing I had to compare it to. That was the only thing I'd ever seen.
Yeah.
And I was like, no. I was like, he talks. He doesn't look like anything's wrong. I said, he's fine. There's no way. This just has to be, you know, some kind of
system.
Yeah.
As a teacher. She was our professor.
And she said, I'm not saying that he is. She said, I'm just saying, why don't you get some videotape of these behaviors and take it to your pediatrician and just let them look and maybe just let's just research a little bit. And honestly, it was the kindest thing she could have done. You know, in those days, we didn't have a phone to whip out. You didn't video everything.
Yeah, no, you had a camera.
You had a camcorder. And we did own a camcorder. And I was like, oh my gosh, why didn't I think of that? That's brilliant. So I started just taking little recordings of his behaviors. And took it in and gave it to my pediatrician. She watched it and she called me immediately that night. And she said, thank you for this tape. I needed to see these things. I had no idea from the things you had mentioned that this is.
Or just his office visit.
You're right.
Right.
It was just. Yeah. She said, and the things you said in office visits, I did not envision what you're showing me on this videotape. She goes, we need to start evaluation immediately. She said that there's definitely something going on here. And it was just like, you know, yeah, it's awful. I mean, I can't.
It's a punch in the stomach.
It is. And it's a shell shock feeling. It's like, you can't believe it. Like, you cannot believe the words that are coming out of someone's mouth. And you're looking at your little child. And I think, and I don't want this to sound at all like callous in any way. It was my reality. And I think it was very close to yours. there weren't the hallmark things. There wasn't the loss
at like, the time.
At the time.
Right? Honestly, I think looking now.
Yeah,
they were. There'd be so much more of it. Of
knowledge of what you should be looking for.
What the spectrum could look like. But at the time, like we're talking late 90s, early 2000s.
Right. They were basically like, no one said the word autism unless your child was completely nonverbal.
Not looking.
Not looking. Would not make eye contact with you.
Had no real perception.
Like self-injurious behaviors. I mean, like.
There were less affected children.
Yeah.
But still, it was like behaviors were.
It was unusual. It really was.
Like, we missed a lot of the check marks, too.
A lot.
It got overlooked because what it was at the time.
Yeah, it was. It was a different world. And I just remember thinking immediately, no. I just remember thinking, no. No, that's not what it is. It's not going to be his reality. That's not what's going to happen. I just remember thinking, no. That's all I could think was just no. Like, I'll get him tested. I'm going to get him tested. But no, he's not. This is not going to be. It's not going to happen. And just no. And so our pediatrician was wonderful, supportive, helpful, got on it, immediately got working on referrals. And that started the long and horrendous and arduous journey of diagnosis. At that time, you had to have more than one entity. I think
professional.
Three. Yeah,
we had to have two.
I think we had to have three. I think we ended up with three and had to agree that he was on the autism spectrum for him to, quote unquote, be diagnosed and get services or whatever.
Accommodation,
whatever he needed. So we started with speech therapy and occupational therapy immediately before he was diagnosed. Like, our pediatrician was great. She was like, you're going to need those regardless. She goes, so whether or not we get a name or a label on it, whatever's going on, something's not going right. Something's aspiring right. Yeah, let's get started. So we got him in with a speech therapist and an occupational therapist, both of whom worked in Charleston, which is an hour and 20 minutes away from us. So there started the days of long treks to and from therapies with little children, getting childcare for Taylor, total disruption of her world. And they were wonderful. They both specialized with kids on the spectrum, but they treated lots of different children, but their specialty was kids on the spectrum. And it took pretty much a whole year of different to get on people's schedules, get him in for the test. A couple people wanted to see him twice. Get all the paperwork done, you know, for every single visit you get.
The evaluation.
Oh, God.
Like, the inventories.
Yeah.
Fill out, like, the self-reporting from, like, the parents.
Yeah.
Parent one, parent two.
Teacher. They want to know.
Whatever.
Yeah. Such and such weeks gestation, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, you want to know how my pregnancy was? I mean, it was.
Yeah.
And then you have to do the same form for everybody. But we took him to three different entities to go through the evaluations that they did at that time. And I remember it was so, everyone was a little confounded by Tanner because his verbal ability was high. And he was asking WH questions. At that time, that was a huge hallmark. Are they asking what, how, where, when, why? And he would. And you know, I remember one of the very first evaluations, they were like, okay, now we're going to be in the other room watching you and you're just going to play with him. And they gave me some different things they wanted me to ask him and do with him. And the first thing he did, they had like a banner up at the top, a border up at the top of the wall that had like the alphabet and pictures. He was like, Mom, what's that like? You know, it was something like that. He points at it, you know, makes a big deal. And I was like, oh, Jace, dude, you know, we brought you in here for this. But as it went on, it became very apparent, you know, some of the things. He had also by that time started adding in some vocalizing. We called it running in, or flapping and humming, or running and humming. It was kind of a humming sound that he would make. It's kind of in the back of his throat.
Yeah.
And then it was sort of like a dull, like a white noise kind of sound. Like he just needed to hear something vibrating. And then he did a lot of squealing, along with the flap. And then, you know, all the eye aversion and the tick. So we went through all the diagnostic process with all these different doctors and clinics. And at that time, Asperger's syndrome, which is not even a relevant diagnosis anymore, was the diagnosis that a lot of people were getting. One entity wanted to call him Asperger's syndrome, two said high functioning autism. So
Which I don't even think they say that anymore.
I don't think they say levels. Yeah. And honestly, that's the part where we admit it. We don't know what's
right.
current.
Yeah.
I don't know what level tenor is. I never leveled. No one ever called him a level. I have no idea.
We like, had him.
Yeah. I have not had tenor reevaluated. I don't know where he would fall today. But, you know, when we got the final paperwork.
Kind of doesn't matter either where they are today.
To me, it does not matter.
We've got two amazing gentlemen that are contributing members.
It doesn't matter.
Like, even before Netflix, they were contributing members.
Absolutely. So, doing so much. Yeah.
So
done, come so far.
Happy full lives.
Yeah. But, you know, it was probably just one of the darkest seasons of our life. I think Mark and I were functioning just kind of from a place of like controlled panic. Like, we have to keep it together. I did forget to mention, during all this time, I had gotten pregnant with Madeline, Midge. And so I'm pregnant, you know, during all this.
During his test.
Yes. So I, you know, and then she was born kind of in the middle of it too. So you're worried, you know, you have this oldest daughter who's precocious and easy and bright and doing everything ahead of time and helpful and smart. This little boy that we're, you know, so scared and concerned about. And then I'm expecting another one. And we were building our house. You know, Mark's running two careers. We're building what is our final home where we live still. And it was a huge undertaking. Mark was subcontracting out himself. Wow. And we're going through all this testing. And then I have a newborn that's nursing, you know. And I was like,
kudos to you, yeah, Mark. Because that puts a lot of strain maritally.
It was awful. It was awful. And we almost didn't have any time to like really process it. I felt like in those days, and it was what people knew, everybody was just so adamant about urgency,
early intervention.
And I agree. I don't think you should sit around and wonder, this is my opinion,
right?
Take it or leave it. But I don't think you should sit around and look at things that you think are unusual and wait and think, oh, maybe it'll go away. I think you should check it out. I think you should get aggressive. But also, It put a sense of like panic in me to where I didn't even really deal with how I was feeling, because I just felt this unbelievable pressure to get him into therapy, to get something set up, to start treating it immediately, to change it. And I felt like it was all on me. And I felt like I had to do it all yesterday. Like you need to be an expert. You need to know what kind of therapy he needs. You need to understand how to talk to these doctors. You need to understand how much these things cost. Martin needs to provide it all and also keep your whole world running. And I was, you know, 30 years old, you know, whatever I was at the time. You know, no, 30 something at that time. And I'm like, and three little kids. And I just remember to be really, because we're trying to be really, really honest.
Yeah.
I just wanted to run.
Yeah.
I just wanted to get away. I loved my children dearly. And I didn't want to run away from them. I didn't want to run away from Mark. I wanted to wake up every morning and have it not be true.
Run away from your reality.
I wanted to run away from this news.
Like, yeah.
I wanted
the people in the picture, yeah, but just different picture.
Different circumstances.
Yeah.
I wanted to wake up every day. I prayed, like, when I would go to sleep, like, I just want to wake up tomorrow and he's going to stop doing that. He's going to quit doing that. If I see his hand go up one more time, you know, I would feel, I can't take it. I can't watch him do this. And at the same time, I was simultaneously feeling like, oh, hell no, I'm not going to accept this. We are going to be the ones. I started avidly, like just voraciously reading all these books that were out at the time.
Remediate them.
Yeah, and all these books of miracle stories and how they did this diet or this therapy or this intervention. And then they have a perfectly normal child who's an engineer now and high functioning and, you know, just they conquered autism. It's gone. There's no sign of it. And I'm a rose-colored glasses person. I'm a believer. I'm a cheerleader. I never really was one, but that's like my personality. That's like how I'm wired. And I really believed if we just hit this thing running and we give him every possible therapy, we're going to beat it. He's going to be that one. He's going to go back to regular school. He's going to graduate from typical college. He did graduate from college, but you know, that he's going to make it. He's going to be totally quote unquote normal. And at that time, that was the only outcome that was acceptable to me. That was the only thing. And if someone said anything different, I didn't blow up, but internally, I would be enraged.
Fuming.
If somebody like tried to act like, you know, long range plan, you know, let's think about the long term when he's an adult needing assistance, I would want to take them by the throat and say, shut the you know what up. Do not speak about my son that way. That is not what's going to happen.
Right.
And I'm just sharing that, like, that is where my mental state was at the time of diagnosis. And I remember, you know, the day that they gave me the final paper. And for whatever reason, I know Mark and I were together, but he had to go back to work. And I came home. And it was like nap time. It was like in the afternoon. I put the kids down for a nap. And I remember just laying on the bed in our bedroom with the paper right beside me and just like staring at the ceiling. And I cried so much that year. I mean, I didn't cry that day. It was weird. I just remember this feeling. I don't know that I've ever felt like, I'll cry now, like that empty. I just felt, just numb, just empty. And also really, really freaking angry. I remember being so damn pissed and just thinking, when I had him, I was happily married. I was 26 years old.
Healthy.
I exercised through my whole pregnancy. I drank my water. I ate my protein. I ate my vegetables. I took my vitamins. I did everything. We love him. We have all this provided for him. And we'll get into later, like the mindset change. But that was where I was. Yes. So if you're watching this or listening to this and you're the mom that's getting that news and you're hearing those words or you're reading that on the piece of paper, and I just remember saying, or seeing high-functioning autism at the top line and then looking at him and you just think, this can't be what's going to happen to him. This cannot be his life. And I remember quite frankly thinking, I don't want to go to therapy.
No.
I hate therapy offices. I hate clinics.
Yeah.
I don't want to talk to an OT.
Yeah.
I want to take him to kindergarten. I want him to go to school with his little buddies.
I want him to be on the little league team.
I want him to play baseball.
Yeah.
I want him to play flag football.
Yeah.
I don't want to go. It sucks. I hate this. Yeah. I'm mad. And this isn't fair.
Yep.
But not one of those are all valid emotions, and those are, it's okay to feel
and
that
way. And that's the thing too. I think like right here's a good place to stop and think about like if you are a younger mom or a dad or a couple that are, you are just getting this news or you're getting your friend going, hey, maybe you should X, Y, or Z for your kid. And you, we didn't have all of these podcasts, social media. We didn't know. And it's like, it was, I remember feeling really lonely. And that's what we're here. We want to be your big sis hug now and just be like, it is okay to feel all those things.
It is okay. It is okay to feel all those things. And you're not wrong. And you're not a bad mom. And you're not, you're not a bad parent. You don't dislike your child. It's because you love your child so much that you just can't. And it's also fear. I mean, just that mountain, like you feel like you are standing at the bottom of this mountain that is just, and you have no idea where the top is. Like you can't even see the top. And you're just like, I got to climb it. I got to do it. I have no choice. And, you know, so that's what diagnosis was like for us. It was horrible. It was rough. It was about a year. By the time we finally actually got the piece of paper, it was right after you turned 4. So, you know, all this started at like that 2.5. And then we started working with our pediatrician. Then we went on the therapies, and it would take months to get appointments. You know, and then we'd wait for this clinic and that clinic. And then they would take another 2 months to get that report back. You know, so all this stretched out over like those 18 months. So that's how he was right shortly, just after 4, when the actual word came back. And that's when we, and we'll do this in a further episode, what therapies we then started. But that's how I felt. And I just want to put it out there that if that's how you're feeling, it's okay. It's okay to feel that way, and it's normal and it's natural. I think it's kind of,
and allow it yourself. Yeah. Even though I similar, and I felt so bad, but I would say allow yourself those feelings and work through them, because you do come out on the other side. But I think you have to go through all the lows.
You do,
and feel them, and I know
intense emotions, but we'll get to the light bulb moments that changed all of that, and this self-realization, which I think is such a huge part of being an autism mom, is you start to realize how much of all of that is about your internal state and getting right in your own heart as you parent that child. But that's for a later. So your turn.
Right.
Tell us about Connor.
Hey. Well, I think a lot of you, like, I don't even remember how much I would have covered in the first episode. And have we talked about kind of who we were before and how we got to where we were?
But really quick, you know, from episode one, I did work at the New England Center for Autism, which is now New England Center for Children. And I did have experience around autistic children.
You sure?
I was, that's what I was all around. I mean, I was
a nanny. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was in the intensive pre-K, nonverbal, high behavior classrooms with parents who were newly diagnosed. So this is what I did.
Yeah.
I was an ABA therapist, and I did respite work for families. We had a family who had twins, boys that were pretty affected.
Yeah, pretty.
And their therapist and I would help on weekends so they could have a date night and just relax.
Wow.
Before I had kids. So then you all know from episode one from us, which I had a lot of fertility issues.
Yep.
And all I ever wanted to do was be a mom. So Connor is our my first child. I'm no longer with Connor's dad, but he was our first child, both of us. Neither of us had had a kid. We tried really hard to have kids. A lot of heartache, a lot of miscarriage, and then fertility treatment. And that puts a massive toll on a marriage.
Oh,
I just, without being too funny, it takes all the fun.
Yeah.
Of like, but, you know, and it really does. You almost start to feel like a science project.
Yeah.
And not so much
it's not romantic.
No, you know, but we wanted to be parents. And so then we finally get blessed with this beautiful little boy.
So
giant brown eyes, big round head, just amazing.
Fresh.
Almost very similar to Tanner's story. Kind of like talked early, was looking at us.
Yeah.
Two word phrases, had receptive language, like go get your shoes.
Yeah.
Go get his shoes. I mean, like, and I'm patting myself on the back like, well, basically, giving birth to Einstein. There it is.
Look at this smart, here's precious
this beautiful
angel.
Gift. Right. Yes. And then started the behaviors that I caught. I would say it was around anywhere from 15 to 18 months.
So really early.
Yeah. Yeah. But I had been working in the autism field. So I saw the methodical lining up of toys that probably got off people's radar.
Yep.
I saw the isolation at playgroups. He did not need anybody to co-experience share. He didn't want to experience share with anybody. He didn't need, if you were there, he didn't share with you. But he was also quite content. And he did this with kids, relatives. And, you know, to the naked eye or like regular family members, everybody just sort of found excuses for it.
Sure.
It bothered me because I knew. But however, still really, really just kind of thought, and this is weird, you know, I think we're both Christian women.
Yeah.
We have a strong faith in Jesus Christ, and that's where we come from. But I would say whatever faith you are, or choose however you choose to center yourself, that's how I was raised in my belief. I just thought, well, God wouldn't do this to me because God knows that what I've already been through. I've been through my trials and now I'm a mom.
Yeah, like so the hard thing was the fertility.
The hard thing was the fertility.
Right.
So
right.
This is going to be it.
I would have thought the same.
So when I started to see the little things, I thought, no. This is off the table, God. You know, I've had my trial.
Yeah.
And so, but it's also for my faith and my journey, he was also, there for me and put people and things in my path that I knew I was not alone. So there was that, which is wonderful.
Yeah.
But, back to going to like playgroups and family and things, everyone just saw the brilliant side of Connor.
Right.
Connor had this memory, even back then, this incredible memory. So my ex-husband, we would be at parties and almost like he was a proud dad. So he wasn't doing it like this. But to me as his mom, I felt like Connor was a poodle and my husband was lighting a flaming hula hoop. And he's like, watch him do this and watch him. Hey, Connor, what about this?
Smart, yeah.
And Connor would just be like doing his thing. And I'm
he's still like so good at like the after goals.
I mean, he's amazing, but it is kind of who he is. But at the time it felt like, okay. And for our next trick, Connor's going to whip a rabbit out.
Right.
You know, like, what are we doing here? So
He's like,
but he had, so that was, as much as you want to think as a parent, my child's brilliant, it was on my radar. It was on my radar. Yeah,
like eating at you in the back.
And then I'll never forget, I was pregnant for twins and we were driving down. We lived in Boston, Massachusetts, and we were visiting friends and we were going down. My blood running cold moment. Was that it? It was a moment with you and Tanner.
Yeah.
And I think it was the trucks.
Yeah.
But my blood ran cold. We were on a windy road and it was icy. It was sunny, but it had snowed and it was icy and the road was slippery. So I remember my husband was driving, but I remember being really focused on, gosh, I hope we're going to get there.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're slippery. And Connor was an only child, was my oldest, and he's in the back and he's completely having conversations
with
himself.
Wow.
And it was specifically an episode of Bob the Builder.
Was he like,
and Bob the Builder, we got a little British cartoon and he was doing the show and he was having the whole thing by himself.
And you remember?
And
oh God,
I kept turning around. I'm like, Connor. And so then I would interrupt it intentionally because it was bothering me. I'm like, why is he doing this? And he'd let me interrupt him. And then I would give him a book. I would redirect, interrupt and redirect. That was what I was trying to do. And
I did.
Here's a book. Here's a snack. Here's a juice. Yeah, whatever.
Whatever.
And then he would toss the book and go right back to the show, right where he left off. And I remember thinking, that's when my blood turned to ice. I was like, this is not okay. I knew it was called echolalia and delayed echolalia. I mean, I knew all the words. And so I started to just approach my husband with, do you think? And so I think you guys know, in a nutshell, I met a lot of resistance from him and started to go to doctors and met a lot of resistance from doctors. To the point where my husband at the time was like, I kind of think it's you. And I think there is something called Munchausen by proxy.
Yeah.
And
like overthinking.
And he was like, you have an issue here. Like you know, this is all you know. This is what you think. And thank God I didn't entertain that for very long because I got pretty sure of myself. Yeah. And it was then Connor started preschool.
Yeah.
And I sent him to the preschool. I had no reason, based off of everybody else's observations, not mine. I believed that he was on the spectrum. No, and I was all by myself. I sent him to preschool. And it was the second or third day the teacher called and was like, you need to come in here. Like, this isn't going well.
Wow.
He's doing this. He's doing that. It was like stimming. And so she was
not engaging.
Not engaging. Inappropriate with the toys in terms of just doing what they weren't there to do.
Right.
Using toys for stims.
Yes.
So that was a moment of just splash in the face. And that's when I was still living in Boston. And I went to Boston Children's Hospital. Didn't get help there. So I felt so confused.
Because
I
knew you're crazy.
I knew my gut. I felt crazy.
Yeah.
I knew something was going on. I couldn't get a doctor to listen to me.
Yeah.
His teachers knew something was going on.
Right.
But Dad still wasn't on the team at all.
Right.
And then we moved to Atlanta. And then that's when I think you've heard my story a few times where I'd now had twins. I had all these other kids. And so now I'm an instant mother of three. I'm just turned 30.
Right.
I've got three kids. And actually, I wasn't even 30. I was 29 and all this
had already happened.
And so we get down to Atlanta a couple of years passed by. And I was at the pediatrician for the twins. And you've heard the story. And long story short, Connor was walking on his toes, doing his story. And finally, the pediatrician there in Atlanta said, I see this. We need to get him tested. So she started with the referrals for a developmental psychologist.
Yes, we did that.
Yeah. And then I found just another psychologist who actually had a son on the spectrum, but didn't. And we had them separately, independently, not even knowing.
Yeah.
We did, like you said, you fill out these inventories.
That really
testing, 27 pages long. Right. And I remember we all had different, and I had to share one with his preschool, his daycare provider, if he had one. Both parents had to report, and they took all of this and mushed it all together with their own observations. And ironically, we got everybody, the two doctors in Atlanta gave us the diagnosis on the same exact day, and it was a Friday afternoon. That was a fluke.
That's just sort of happening that way. Yeah.
And You know, you said Mark was at work and you went and laid down on the bed. My husband and I found ourselves at a Mexican restaurant with a pitcher of margaritas.
Yeah, we just, yeah.
Were
like, oh my God.
Oh my gosh. And I think it was more just shock. For me, it was the shock that I was right.
Yeah.
And he was now five.
Yeah.
So I pulled up a 5-year story really quick, but he's now 5 years old. And all I knew was early intervention. Yeah. And what I was there in my initial
and
job.
Yeah, the college. Yeah.
And those parents were getting services. And I've blown 3-4 right. years, whatever I felt like it was, of seriously helping him. So anger didn't even scratch the surface. Yeah. Mostly angry with myself. And then a grief hit me like I've never felt before of just mourning this little boy that I thought I had. And even though all signs pointed in different directions that I didn't have this little boy.
It's a lot to wrap your mother brain around. It is a lot.
And when you finally see it in black and white.
Yeah. And some professional confirms it.
Yeah.
And says, yeah, you're right. This is what it is.
And what's so interesting is what I learned later, and I don't know if this happened to you. Family members and friends came out of the woodwork after.
Yeah.
After. I didn't have a good friend like Jody. Was it Jody for you?
Yeah.
Of course, friends in that back in the day, you were good friends. You were doing what you thought. But I apparently had people in our orbit who were seeing things.
And not
saying anything.
Yeah.
We actually had a couple friend that babysat him for us. And they said, you know, we tried and tried and tried to play with him. And he wouldn't play with us. And they were showering all their love and attention on just him. And
he wasn't engaging, yeah.
Wasn't engaging, wasn't experiencing sharing, wasn't doing any of that. And so it was just interesting to see after the diagnosis was official and we kind of like let the family know, our friends, people were like, well, geez, you know, we always thought that time at that Christmas party when he was, and I was like, and at that point, I don't know, I just didn't want to hear it.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, I knew
like it. Too little, too late.
Yeah.
A little bit. Yeah.
Thing. Yeah. So, and then some of the things we needed to address was physically Connor toe walked. That's the only
way he walked. Was that his biggest? Yeah. So he
did a lot of other. Yeah. He did a lot of the stimming. Connor.
But that will like shorten their Achilles.
Tendons. The tendons and the ankles. And then we even learned that if we had continued to not do something more drastic, because he was really, really toe walking, that he could actually injure his knee joints.
Right. Tip forward like that. Yeah.
And he could start to have, you know, bigger, orthopedic issues as he aged. So we made a really tough decision. It's kindergarten, first grade to have the surgery. And then he had to wear what was called AFOs, but they were like little braces. And I saved them. I still have them. They're super cute. Yeah. He picked a space. We picked the plastic and they made it look like space. They were
put in me just that. And you've got twins.
I've got twins.
I mean, you're like, I mean, that's enough. I mean, like a little preschooler and twin babies or toddlers. And then to have to make a surgery decision.
Surgery.
Yeah, and you put your child in surgery, even if it's just for tubes. It's so freaking stressful.
Stressful. It was a lot. It was a lot. And then now he's in these little boots and he's going to go to school for the first time.
And
get on the school bus with little fifth graders. And I was so, so scared for him. I didn't want him to get picked on. And I just, and we called him his space boots.
Right.
And I even had to sleep in them and they weren't comfortable and it was just awful. And it almost feels like another life. He has never walked on his toe since.
It does feel like another life. It really does.
He has a funny walk though. When I do watch him, he's very heel toe.
Uh-huh.
Next time you guys see him.
It really pretty sense.
It's a pretty
like he
the plodding.
Yeah.
But and
I'll have to watch it.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's just kind of how I think he after that he learned.
He kind of probably relearned to walk a little bit.
With a different
gait. Yeah.
And a form. So that was interesting and that was just hard. And again, it's like all these other things that autism brought was that surgery and then just the daunting task now of, okay, I was like a provider for early intervention kids in a very specific therapy in a very specific, and I was monitored by staff, very specific plan of execution for these kids. That was designed by people a lot smarter than me, a lot higher up the tree than me. Now I've got my own kid.
Yeah.
And I've got to be his advocate.
Yeah.
And now what? Now where do we go? Now what is
his therapist, his advocate, his teacher, his medical decision maker. But you really just want to be his mom. You know, you really just want to love him and protect him and keep him from all this hard stuff and make it not true. But you can't. You got to do all those other things.
You just, and he had to like, do it. Get out of my comfort zone and really,
yeah,
and just jump in. And then at the time when his dad did get on board and got in the boat. But I mean, you know, I would say, and we'll get into this. Hopefully we'll have a nice episode with the husbands.
Yes.
Is my second husband and Mark and her stuck it out, which is amazing. Is, you know, the stress on the marriage. Uh-huh. And I would also say if you're a young family, and I don't know who might need to hear this.
Yeah.
And I mean, obviously my story has worked out, but if I had to go back in time, team up, be on each other's team, believe in each other, support each other. And the best gift you can give your family is a strong marriage and a good marriage, and or just really fight for your family, because it adds another layer of heart.
It adds such an unbelievable layer of heart.
And it's like, I think too, that the dynamic of, you know, at the beginning, I was saying he was autistic, he was saying he wasn't. And then we had fertility issues before that. Now, okay, all of a sudden, let's throw some twins in there. Our marriage took a lot of licks and it didn't survive.
Very quickly. Yeah, very rapidly.
It didn't survive. But I would say the one thing I wish we had done was kind of been on each other's team a little bit better than it was, than we were. So if you are listening to this and you're a young, newly diagnosed couple, family, and you find yourself at odds with your partner, if you can show this one part just to your other who may not be on the team, just try to row the boat together. I'm promising you, you're going to go farther, and it's going to be a benefit for everybody, because going through a divorce in a situation like I
can't imagine. I don't know how you did it. It was unbearable. Yeah, I bet. And I would add on to that, you know, being in a marriage that is long and is the original two parents, like, yes, we made it. We did, but not without scars. And Mark will be very transparent about that too. It scarred us. It scarred us individually. It scarred us as a couple. I feel like we have some areas of communication and closeness that are not as good as they should be, or maybe would have been had we not gone through the special needs journey. And I think the way Mark and I are both very independent, we're both very stubborn. And I think maybe the reason we were good at delegation. This is your job, Nikki. This is your job, Mark. Now freaking go. And we're both
good. Your position on the team.
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to play my position. And we did not get in each other's way. We did. But I will say, where we failed, and we failed big, was emotionally holding each other up. And if I could give a little piece of advice as the person who is long married, don't expect your partner to feel the way you feel. Mark did not process it the way I did. He did not express his emotion the way I did. I was so emotional, as I'm sure you can tell. I was wicked emotional for years. Believe it or not, I'm way under more control now. It may not seem that way, but I am. And I had so much resentment toward him. And I harbored it like, and I've had to ask forgiveness, and I still need to do better, letting him know that I appreciate everything that he did and that I'm so thankful that he stuck with me and that he loved us and provided for us and never threw in the towel. But your partner has to process their grief and their acceptance and their even definition of what it's going to mean in their own way. And you can't hold it against them. And they need to extend you the same grace. You know what I mean? They need to, if you're a crier and they're not, they need to let you cry.
I'm listening right now to you because I didn't make it.
And looking back, it was not Mark's job to fix it for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was somehow holding that over his head. It wasn't conscious. You know what I mean? I didn't consciously think that. But I think I kept waiting for him, you know, to somehow have the answer or
lead your
family. Somehow that wasn't his job. He did his job. He did it beautifully. He provided like a rock star. He worked his ass off so that we could maintain a very comfortable, wonderful life and provide for this child's unbelievable amount of need. And it was incredibly financially stressful, but he did it. And I have to think, I wasn't looking at him as an individual with needs at that time. I was just looking at him as my teammate and like, help him. You're his dad. Help him. Help me. Help him. And I know it's a huge tall order. It's such a tall order to remember to put your spouse first. But I did a really shitty job of that. I really did. And we somehow made it.
Yeah.
Somehow we still made it. I guess we forgave each other along the way, and we had some rough years.
Yeah.
We've had years where things have been tough. We've had years where we have not been in love, and he'll say the same thing. And it's been rough. But if I could go back, if you're listening to this and you're there, just remember your son or daughter is going to grow up. They are. And you might be shocked at how independent they become.
Yeah.
And hopefully your spouse will still be there. And don't let this, you know, don't let the way they handle it or the way they don't handle it, you know, I'm talking, of course, within the realms of still being responsible. You know, don't define their journey for them, and they shouldn't define your journey for you. Give each other a lot of grace and just keep talking. Don't assume how they're feeling. They should not assume how you're feeling. Get it out. There's just so many things I would.
And that's the thing, like, for me, and like, and again, I think I want to caveat with what you're saying, as long as you're within the, like, not being in a healthy, not abusive relationship.
Right.
I wasn't with Connor's dad. I think by the time Connor got diagnosed, I blamed him.
Yeah.
I was so mad at him. Like,
yeah,
we would be so much further down this road if you had just listened to me.
If you had
agreed. And you didn't believe me and you didn't listen to me. And that just turned into such a, instead of being like next to each other, shoulder to shoulder, we just became like head to head.
Yeah.
And then we just, I couldn't forgive him. And I don't think no matter what that poor man did or tried, he could climb out of it. The hole that I had dug for him.
Right.
And
don't you think there's so much grief and anger and it's got to go somewhere? It's not going to go to the child.
No.
You know, it's not going to go to your child. You love your baby. You know, it's not, it wasn't for me anyway.
Yeah.
You're not going to spit it at the, you know, caretakers, your girlfriends who are helping you. Who's the likely person that's going to take it? Your spouse. You know, I mean, it's so easy to do that.
And it's just too, I think, like, what, we're in our late 20s, early 30s. So there's not a lot of, you know, I'm not saying we were babies, but,
you know, there's a lack of maturity.
There's a lack of maturity. A lot of
experience.
I look back now and actually Connor's dad and I have had a phone call or two over the years. I'm not saying we're all hearts and flowers all the time, but he has said to me on more than one occasion post-divorce, there's no other woman in this world that would have wanted to be the mother of my kids. And he has said that to me more than once.
Nice. Yeah.
So, you know, I think, and now, it's interesting, I think, where we've landed and where we've had to just get out and carry on with life as a broken family. You know, he got to define a role for himself with Connor.
Yeah.
And, I see that getting better and better over the years.
He loves him.
Yeah. He loves his with his dad now. And
he's with him today. Yeah. I mean, that's so good. I mean,
it is good. I just think, you know, if I could go back and tap.
Yeah.
That, you know, 29, 30 year old on the shoulder. Gosh, what I would tell her.
Oh.
Put my ego, my anger down or go work it out in a healthier way than I did.
Me too. Me too.
Just honestly, I would say,
I think whether you make it or don't, it's going to be hard. And just, you know, it's going
to
be hard. It's
a lot easier to stick it.
It's not undoable, but it is going to put an unbelievable extra strain on your marriage. And holding that so dear and so, you know, just as the most precious thing, it is so hard to clearly see the importance of that when you're in it.
When it feels
impossible because all I could think about was the children.
And I was so, and I remember just even when I would just, I was so mad at his dad, I didn't even almost want to be in the same room as him sometimes. And that was just not, it was just a lot happening in a short period of time.
Yeah.
Sounds like you too. And
oh, yeah.
I think at the end of the day, you know, we just need to, like I said, give each other some grace and try to, you know, just
not put unrealistic expectations on that partner's
health, that grace.
Yes.
And like I said, we both want you to hear it from our mouths. Like, I looked at Connor and would be in sheer fear and panic over not even just, I wasn't even thinking about his adult life for a while.
Me either.
I was thinking about, is he going to get bullied?
Yes.
Are kids going to beat him up? Or, you know, is he going to be picked on? Is he going to be alone? It was that that I couldn't even stomach allowing myself to picture middle school and high school.
Well, I was thinking so much of all the loss too, and feeling very taken from and feeling very unfairly burdened. You know, I was thinking of all the things we weren't going to do, all the things we weren't going to see. And I would, you know, just through the, you know, the school years, you know, all the things he wasn't going to be able to do. And I remember feeling literally sick at the thought of having to go to a special school. And I feel so bad looking back now, like, why did I feel that way? Because those places, I mean, they do so much good and such amazing professionals who are just, they're not even, I don't really think the professionals, they're angels with a calling, you know what I mean, that want to work in those fields. And I had such resentment and so much anger about it.
And I think what we're hoping you can look at with our literally 20, I'm 20 years into this journey.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
you are,
yeah,
too. You're 20, okay. 21 years, yeah, into it with our boys is what a gift.
Mm-hmm.
What a gift.
Yeah.
This diagnosis has actually been to our family in terms of just even when, despite all the tribulations of my personal life, watching his siblings, watching the, yeah, beautiful souls, and we're going to do an episode with the siblings that I got to raise because,
yeah,
they had, we had somebody in our family who needed a little extra love and support. And yeah, I've got three younger children that have the most amazing character. And I can tell you, I know hers do.
And same as six other amazing young people that are profoundly impacted by having a special sibling.
And it doesn't even just preclude to autistic individuals. My children have tolerance for very different people.
Yes.
In any way.
Yeah.
And
soft heart, and servant heart. Yeah. A helper heart.
So you have these children be so accepting and just taught and kind and good, and that's what you want. And so what having an autistic human being in our family has done, the people that have come into my life, I have made friends with so many people, yes, with kids on the spectrum, and these were women, now you,
yeah, like the cool
that are like sisters, yeah, to me. I mean, I have a friend, Allie, like I cannot imagine my life without her. And yeah, and it's like there are people who have been brought to me, and then just things I've learned, and then just the gift, that the lens that Connor brought into our family,
yeah,
and sometimes the way he sees the world. And I mean, I do understand, and we are not insensitive at all.
Oh no,
to you families who have adult children on the spectrum with high behaviors and nonverbal,
yeah,
skills, and you know, I'm not saying, but I do believe in, you know, there is somewhere in your life, in your world, in your orbit, where you can see somehow that we've been chosen,
yep,
to raise these wonderful human beings and for a reason. And we need each other as a community. And we also, even though Connor and Tanner,
yeah,
are verbal and are, you know, doing what they're doing with their, yep, lives, we want to be every bit as much of a resource and support to all the kids on the spectrum and, yeah, families on the spectrum,
no matter where they're functioning,
wherever, yeah, you're at and where you find yourself day to day. And sometimes, you know, even with Connor, the way he has presented, there were days where it was fine, hard to find the positive. But I have to, yeah, say, 20 years in, there's been so much more good,
yeah,
goodness and contribution to my life. I have a richer life because of it.
Yeah.
And when I sit and think about crying Lise feeling sorry for herself.
Yeah. And that's what it was. That's what a lot of it was.
I
hate to admit that, but it was.
It was.
Feeling sorry for myself.
Now I'm like, thank
you. That's kind of what made us who we are. I mean, really. I mean, like, really, it's kind of, it puts you through a fire and you can let it ruin you or make you come out better.
It's
and,
like a diamond, like,
yeah,
right? It's like a diamond. Diamonds are so beautiful, but they get made under so much pressure and heat and flame and fire. And,
yeah,
and then they come out this beautiful, shiny rock.
Yeah,
and
it's amazing. It is.
We have a couple of diamonds for boys, and I've got diamonds in my life now.
Yeah.
And I just think, you know,
you
trust the journey.
Yeah. And, you know, I think when I finally kind of realized there was never another Tanner, like there was no, I think for the longest time I really thought there was some, I hate to keep using the word, normal little boy that was just hiding, masked by this little autism thing that we were going to find the cure for, fix, and kick to the curb. And then the real Tannen was going to stand up. He's not there. He was never there. This is who he is. And when I look back now, I'm like, oh my God, I see it now. And I see where like every little step of the way, even when I wasn't praying, when I wasn't being faithful, like, you know, to God, what I'm saying, when I wasn't being surrendered, when I wasn't looking for the good, God was still providing.
Mm-hmm.
He was putting all the right people in my path. Mm-hmm. He was making situations work out. He was providing the right school setting. And Tannen was slowly but surely becoming who he is today. And now I'm watching God use his life in such amazing, impactful ways. Who might he have been? You know what I mean? Like,
no.
He was never meant to be anything else.
So much joy.
Yeah. And Connor, too. I mean, this is who they were supposed to be for such a moment as now. And it's just so, and I know it's so hard when you first get that paper and you think, oh my God, everything I ever envisioned in my life is not going to happen. But then after you live a while,
it's not our plan.
And guess what?
It doesn't. The plan is really so much better.
It is.
And I never
thought I'd be saying this. I never thought I'd accept it. I never thought I'd be okay with it. And now I used to cry about like Tannen never getting married. And of course, I don't know if he will, but you know, it's probably less likely than for a typical. And if he does get married, there would be a level of assistance that they would need. And that used to literally make me want to vomit. And I thought, I'll never be okay with that. I'll never be okay with the fact that I won't go to his wedding or that I won't have grandchildren from him. But now I'm like, maybe that's not his role. Maybe that's not what God had intended for him. Maybe that's not how he's going to impact the world. And what I'm realizing is that was all about me.
Mm-hmm.
That was all about me. It wasn't about me really thinking about how God was going to use Tannen to impact this world in a positive way. It was about me thinking about what I wanted.
From Tannen.
Yeah. And that's huge. That is huge. And it's so flipping hard to let go of it.
It's so, I feel too so lucky that, you know, again, we both are on this wild ride and we're here because the boys were put out in front of a global stage on this show. And the reason we're specifically here is because a lot of you out there have asked for us to step kind of forward and talk about, okay, we see you and we see them. So how did A go to Z? And so that's why we're here. We're here because of pretty big requests that you want to hear from us. And so we're happy to kind of come out and do this and talk about, again, whatever you guys are going to want to talk about and bring you some cool stories. But at the end of the day, I feel so glad that I get to share Connor with all of you. And you get to see the absolute cool dude that we've been able to hang out with for 25 years. And now you guys are going to get to enjoy him.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
And get some seriously insightful facts along your way.
History.
Yeah, you got it. You guys
run. Maybe with a little British flair. Anyway.
And if you want to hear some really weird OCD dinosaur facts, you'll get those from us.
We would love that. I mean, Tannen just, you know, I was just really quick story. We had, we're at, my home, and we had Tannen over. We'd promised to take Tannen to eat at this restaurant, and we had Tannen here for lunch earlier. And I had a pretty rough morning, I'll just say that. I had some, life, just personal stuff going on in my life. And I literally, it was about 20 minutes before they got here, and I said to my husband, I said, you know, this really sucked today. This little thing happened, and the best thing that I'm excited, so I'm going to get a shot of Tannen.
That's right.
That's what Tannen brings to this world. Like I knew, and I have since Tannen walked this door and he just told me how beautiful I was and hugged me and he loved on me.
Cute and beautiful.
He's just
cute and beautiful.
Wonderful. And I mean, that's the stuff. So, you know, keep the faith.
Yeah.
I would say, like I told my kids, you know, when we talk about,
keep
pedaling your bike. Yes. Going to tip over if you don't, just keep on going. And I'm just glad
then you're not alone. And then we felt that way too. However you're feeling, I'm sure we experienced the same emotion.
Yeah,
sure we did.
Don't be mad at yourself for feeling it.
No.
But don't stay there.
Yes.
Just don't stay there.
Give yourself a minute, but then get up.
Get up and go.
Then you got to get up. So I think that's a good place to wrap up.
I think so.
Episode 2. And we'll get into therapy and our thoughts on that maybe. And then it's coming up.
I think we took two different approaches.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we did. So we can get into that and we're going to do a sibling episode. We're going to do a dad episode. And then maybe we'll...
Probably husbands. I don't know if Connor's dad will be.
Yeah.
Maybe husbands. We'll do Tanner's dad and Connor's stepdad.
There you go. And then we'll do... Maybe we'll start deviating a little bit after that.
Have some
see
fun.
Where it takes us. So
listen, one other thing. We really want to interact with you guys.
Yes.
So we are going to have... we'll have a space on a website for comments. We would love if you're catching this on a YouTube, comment to us or DM us.
Yeah,
because we want to interact.
Yeah,
we want
topic suggestions. Yes,
topic suggestions. Yes. Ask question. Tell us what you think. But we'd love to kind of speak back to you through the camera of the next episode. So please feel free to reach out.
I love it.
All right.
Okay.
I'm good. So you know, love you, mean it.
Love you, mean it.
Bye.
Bye.